Chapter 7. The Dome in the Barrens. 1. Seen from the expressway at 4:45 in the morning, Boston seems a city of the dead brooding over some tragedy in its past. A plague, perhaps, or a curse. The smell of salt, heavy and cloying, comes off the ocean. Runners of early morning fog obscure much of what movement would be seen otherwise. Driving north along Storrow Drive, sitting behind the wheel of the black 84 Cadillac he picked up from Butch Corrington at Cape Cod Limousin, Eddie Cosbrook thinks you can feel this city's age. Perhaps you can get that feeling of age nowhere else in America but here. Boston is a sprat compared with London, an infant compared with Rome, but by American standards, at least it is old. Old. It kept its place on these low hills 300 years ago, when the tea and stamp taxes were unthought of, Paul Revere and Patrick Henry and Bourne. Its age, its silence, and the foggy smell of the sea, all of these things make Eddie nervous. When Eddie's nervous, he reaches for his aspirator. He sticks it in his mouth and triggers a cloud of revivifying spray down his throat. There are a few people on the streets he's passing. On a pedestrian or two on the walkways of the overpasses. They give light to the impression that he has somehow wandered into Lovecrafty tale of doomed cities, ancient evils, and monsters with unpronounceable names. Here, ganged around the bus stop with a sign reading, Clinton Square City Center, kisses waitresses, nurses, suit employees, their faces naked and puffed with sleep. That's right. Eddie thinks, now passing under a sign with Church Tobin Bridge. That's right, stick to the buses. Forget the subways. The subways are a bad idea. I wouldn't go down there if I were you. Not down below. Not in the tunnels. This is a bad thought to have. If he doesn't get rid of it, he will soon be using the aspirator again. He's glad for the heavier traffic on the Tobin Bridge. He passes a monument works. Painted on the brick side. It's a slightly unsettling admonishment. Slow down, we can wait. Here is a green reflectorized sign which reads 295 Main, N. Point H, all northern New England points. He looks at it, and suddenly a bone-deep shudder racks his body. His hands momentarily weld themselves to the wheel of the Cadillac. He would like to believe it is the onset of some sickness, a virus or perhaps one of his mother's phantom fevers, but he knows better. It is the city behind him, poised silently on the straight edge that runs between day and night, and what that sign promises ahead of him. He's sick, all right, no doubt about that, but it's not a virus or a phantom fever. He has been poisoned by his own memories. I'm scared, Eddie thinks. That was always what was at the bottom of it, just being scared. That was everything, but in the end, I think we turned it around somehow. We used it. But how? He can't remember. He wonders if any of the others can. For all their sakes, he certainly hopes so. A truck drones by on his left. Eddie has still got his lights on, and now he hits his brights momentarily as the truck draws safely ahead. He does this without thinking. It has become an automatic function, just part of driving for a living. The unseen driver in the truck flashes his running lights in return. Quickly, twice, thanking Eddie for his courtesy. If only everything could be that simple and that clear, he thinks. He follows the signs to 195. The northbound traffic is light, although he observes that the southbound lanes into the city are starting to fill up. Even at this early hour, Eddie follows the big car along, pre-guessing most of the directional signs and getting into the correct lane long before he has to. It has been years, literally years, since he has guessed wrong enough to be swept past an exit he wanted. He makes his lane choices as automatically as he flashed okay to cut back in to the tracker, as automatically as he once found his way through the tangle of birds in the Dury Barrens. The fact that he has never before in his life driven out of downtown Boston, one of the most confusing cities in America to drive in, does not seem to matter much at all. He suddenly remembers something else about that summer, something Bill said to him one day. You've got a compass in your head, Eddie. How that had pleased him. It pleases him again as the 84 Dorado shoots back onto the turnpike. He slides the limo speed up to a cop-safe 57 miles an hour and finds some quiet music on the radio. He supposes he would have died for Bill back then, if that had been required. And Bill had asked him, and he would simply have responded, "Sir, Big Bill, you got a time in mind yet?" And he laughs at this. Not much of a sound, just a snort, but the sound of it startles him into a real laugh. He laughs seldom these days, and he certainly did not expect to find many jokes, which is worth meaning chuckles, as in, "You got any good jokes today, Ed?" on this black pilgrimage. But he supposes, if God is dirty man enough to curse the faithful with what they want most in life, he is maybe quirk enough to deal you a good joke or two along the ways. "You had any good joke lately yet?" he says out loud, and laughs again. Man, he had hated it when Richie called him Ed, but he had sort of liked it, though. The way he thought Ben Henscombe got to like Richie calling him Haystack. It was something like a secret name, a secret identity, a way to be people that had nothing to do with their parents' fears, hopes, constant demands. Richie couldn't do his beloved voices for shit, but maybe he didn't know how important it was for grapes like them to sometimes beat different people. Eddie glances at the change lined up neatly on the Dorado's dashboard. Lining up the change is another of those automatic tricks of the trade. When the tall boots come up, you never want to have to dig for your silver. Never want to find that you've gotten in an automatic toll lane with the wrong change. Among the coins are two or three Susan V. Anthony silver dollars. They are coins, he reflects, that you probably only find in the pockets of chauffeurs and taxi drivers from the New York area these days. Just as the only place you are up to see a lot of $2 bills is at the racetrack payoff window. He always keeps a few on hand because the robot toll taker baskets on the George Washington and the Triboro bridges take them. Another of those lights suddenly comes on in his head. Silver dollars. Not these fake copper sandwiches, but real silver dollars, with Lady Liberty dressed in her gorgeous robes stamped upon them. Ben Henscombe's silver dollars. Yes, but wasn't it Bill who once used one of those silver cartwheels to save their lives? He's not quite sure of this. Is, in fact, not quite sure of anything. Or is it just that he doesn't want to remember? It was dark in there, he thinks suddenly. I remember that much. It was dark in there. Boston is well behind him now, and the fog is starting to burn off. Ahead is Maine, NH, all northern New England points. Dory is ahead, and there is something in Dory which should be 27 years dead, and yet is somehow not. Something with as many faces as Lone Janey. But what is it, really? Didn't they see it at the end as it really was? With all its masks cast aside? Oh, he can remember so much, but not enough. He remembers that he loved Bill Denbrough. He remembers that well enough. Bill never made fun of his asthma. Bill never called him little sissy queer boy. He loved Bill like he would have loved a big brother or a father. Bill knew stuff to do, places to go, things to see. Bill was never up against it. When you ran with Bill, you ran to beat the devil and you laughed. But you hardly ever ran out of breath. And hardly ever running out of breath was great. So fucking great, they would tell the world. When you ran with Big Bill, you got your chucks every day.
Sure, kid. Every day.
He says in a rich Dozier voice and laughs again. It had been Bill's idea to make the dome in the Barrens. And it was, in a way, the dome that had brought them all together. Ben Henscombe had been the one to show them how the dam could be built, and they had built it so well that they gotten in a lot of trouble with Mr. Nell the cop on the bed. But it had been Bill's idea, and although all of them except Richie had seen very odd things, frightening things, in Dury since the turn of the year, it had been Bill who had first found the courage to say something out loud. That damn. That doomed them. He remembered Victor Chris.
Ta-da, boys. I was a real baby then. Believe me, you're better off without it.
A day later, Ben Henscombe was grinning at them, saying,
We could flood out the...
2.
Wall Barrens if we wanted to.
Bill and Eddie looked at Ben doubtfully, and then at the stuff Ben had brought along with him. Some boards, scrunched from the Mr. McKibbon's backyard, but that was okay, since Mr. McKibbon's had probably scrunched them from someone else, a sledgehammer, a shovel.
I don't know,
Eddie said, glancing at Bill.
When we tried yesterday, it didn't work very good. The current kept washing our sticks away.
This will work,
Ben said. He also looked to Bill for the final decision.
Well, let's give it a try,
Bill said.
I called Richie Tozier this morning. He's gonna be over later. He's said, maybe him and Stanley will want to help.
Stanley who?
Ben asked.
Yuri's,
Eddie said. He was still looking cautiously at Bill, who seemed somehow different today. Quieter, less enthusiastic about the idea of the dam. Bill looked pale today. Distant.
Stanley Uris? I guess I don't know him. Does he go to the real elementary?
He's our age, but he just finished the fourth grade,
Eddie said.
He started school a year late because he was sick a lot when he was a little kid. You think you took chunk yesterday. You just ought to be glad you're not Stan. Someone's always rocking Stan to the dogs and back. He's Joyce,
Bill said.
Lots of kids don't like him because he's Joyce.
Oh, yeah?
Ben asked, impressed.
Joyce, huh?
He paused, and then said carefully,
is that like being Turkish, or is it more like, you know, Egyptian?
I guess it's more like Turkish.
Bill said. He picked up one of the boards Ben had brought and looked at it. It was about 6 feet long and 3 feet wide.
My dad says most Jews have big noses and lots of money, but Stan got a regular nose and he's always broke,
Eddie said.
Yeah,
Bill said, and broke into a real grin for the first time that day. Ben grinned. Eddie grinned. Bill tossed the board aside, got up, and burst off the seat of his jeans. He walked to the edge of the stream, and the other two boys joined him. Bill shoved his hands in his back pockets and sighed deeply. Eddie was sure Bill was going to say something serious. He looked from Eddie to Ben, and then back to Eddie again, not smiling now. Eddie was suddenly afraid. But all Bill said then was,
you got your aspirator, Eddie?
Eddie slapped his pocket.
I'm loaded for bear.
Say, how did it work with the chocolate milk?
Ben asked. Eddie laughed.
Worked great,
he said. He and Ben broke up while Bill looked at them, smiling but puzzled. Ed explained, and Bill nodded, grinning again.
Eddie's mum is worried that he's gonna break and she won't be able to get a refund.
Eddie snorted and made as if to push him into the stream.
Watch it, fuckface,
Bill said, sounding uncannily like Henry Bowers.
I'll twist your head so far around you'll be able to watch when you're piped yourself.
Ben collapsed, shrieking with laughter. Bill glanced at him, still smiling, hands still in the back pockets of his jeans. Smiling, yeah, but a little distant again, a little vague. He looked at Eddie and then cocked his head toward Ben.
It's soft,
he said.
Yeah,
Eddie agreed, but he felt somehow that they were only going through the motions of having a good time. Something was on Bill's mind. Who supposed Bill would spill it when he was ready? The question was, did Eddie want to hear what it was?
It's mentally retarded.
Retarded,
Ben said, still giggling.
You gonna show us how to build the dam, or are you gonna sit there on your big can all day?
Ben got to his feet again. He looked first at the stream, throwing past them at moderate speed. The Kinderskick was not terribly wide this far up in the Barrens, but it had defeated them yesterday just the same. Neither Eddie nor Bill had been able to figure out how to get a foothold on the current. But Ben was smiling, the smile of one who contemplates doing something now. Something that will be fun, but not very hard. Eddie thought,
he knows how. I really think he does.
Okay,
he said.
You guys want to take your shoes off, because you're gonna get your little footsies wet.
The mind mother in Elder's head spoke up at once, her voice as stern and commanding as the voice of a traffic cop.
Don't you dare do it, Teddy. Don't you dare.
Wait to it. That's one way. One of the thousand of ways that cold search and cold leads to new money. So don't you do it.
Bill and Ben were sitting on the bank, pulling off their sneakers and socks. Ben was fiercely rolling up the legs of his jeans. Bill looked up at Teddy. His eyes were clear and warm, sympathetic. And he was suddenly sure Big Bill knew exactly what he had been thinking, and he was ashamed.
You coming?
Yeah, sure,
Eddie said. He sat down on the bank and undressed his feet while his mother rounded inside his head. But her voice was growing steadily more distant and echoey. He was relieved and out, as if someone had stuck a heavy fish hook through the back of her blouse and was now rolling her away from him down a very long corridor. 3. It was one of those perfect summer days which, in a world where everything was on track and on the beam, you would never forget. A moderate breeze kept the worst of the mosquitoes and blackface away. The sky was a bright, crisp blue. Temperatures were in the low 70s. Birds sing and went about their bird business in the busies and second growth trees. And he had to use his spray to once. And then his chest lightened and his throat seemed to widen magically to the size of a freeway. He spent the rest of the morning with it stuffed forgotten into his back pocket. Ben Henscomb, who had seemed so timid and unsure the day before, became a confident general once he was fully involved in the actual construction of the dam. Every now and then, he would climb the bank and stand there with his muddy hands on his hips, looking at the work in progress and muttering to himself. Sometimes, he would run a hand through his hair, and by 11 o'clock, it was standing up in crazy, comical spikes. Eddie felt uncertainty at first, then a sense of glee, and finally, an entirely new feeling. One that was at the same time weird, terrifying, and exhilarating. It was a feeling so alien to his usual state of being that he was not able to put a name to it until that night, lying in bed and looking at the ceiling and replaying the day. Power. That was what that feeling had been. Power. It was going to work, by God, and it was going to work better than he and Bill, maybe even Ben himself, had dreamed it could. He could see Bill getting involved, only a little at first, still mulling over whatever it was he had on his mind, and then, bit by bit, committing himself fully. Once or twice he clapped Ben on one meaty shoulder and told him he was unbelievable. Ben flushed with pleasure each time. Ben got Eddie and Bill to set one of the boards across the stream and hold it as he used the sledgehammer to set it in the stream bed.
There, it's in, but you'll have to hold it or the current will just pull it loose,
he told Eddie. So Eddie stood in the middle of the stream holding the board while water sluiced over its top and made his hands into wavering starfish shapes. Ben and Bill located a second board 2 feet downstream of the first. Ben used the sludge again to set it, and Bill held it while Ben began to fill up the space between the two boards with sandy earth from the stream bank. At first, it only washed away around the ends of the boards in gritty clouds, and Eddie didn't think it was going to work at all. But when Ben began adding rocks and muddy gook from the stream bed, the clouds of escaping silt began to diminish. In less than 20 minutes, he had created a heaped brown kernel of earth and stones between the two boards in the middle of the stream. To Eddie, it looked like an optical illusion.
If we had real cement, instead of just mud and rocks, they'd have to move the whole city over to the old cape side by the middle of next week,
Ben said, slinging the shovel aside at last and sitting on the bank until he got his breath back. Bill and Eddie laughed, and Ben grinned at them. When he grinned, there was a ghost of the handsome man he would become in the lines of his face. Water had begun to pile up behind the upstream board now. Eddie asked what they were going to do about the water escaping around the sides.
Let it go. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't?
Nope.
Why not?
I can't explain exactly. You gotta let some out, though.
How do you know?
Ben shrugged.
I just do,
the shrug said, and Eddie was silenced.
When he was rested, Ben got a third board, the thickest of the four or five he had carried laboriously across town to the barns, and placed it carefully against the downstream board, wedging one hand firmly into the stream bed and socking the other against the board Bill had been holding, creating the strut he had put in his little drawing the day before.
"Okay,"
he said, standing back. He grinned at them.
"You guys should be able to let go now. The cooking between the two boards will take most of the water pressure. The strut will take the rest."
"Won't the water wash it away?"
Eddie asked.
"Nope. The water is just gonna push it in deeper."
"And if you're drunk, we get to kill you,"
Bill said.
"That's cool,"
Ben said amiably. Bill and Eddie stepped back. The two boards that formed the basis of the dam quaked a little, tilted a little. And that was all.
"God shit!"
Eddie screamed, excited.
"It's great," Bill said, grinning.
"Yeah,"
Ben said.
"Let's eat."
4. They sat on the bank and ate, not talking much, watching the water stir up behind the dam and sluice around the ends of the boards. They had already done something to the geography of the stream banks. Now they saw. The diverted current was cutting scalloped hollows into them. As he watched, the new curve of the stream undercut the bank enough on the far side to cause a small avalanche. Upstream of the dam, the water formed a roughly circular pool, and at one place it had actually overflowed the bank. Bright, reflecting rills ran off into the grass and the underbrush. Eddie slowly began to realize what Ben had known from the first. The dam was already built. The gaps between the boards and the banks were sluice ways. Ben had not been able to tell Eddie this because he didn't know the word. Above the boards, the Kandiski had taken on a swelled look. The chuckling sound of shallow water bubbling its way over stones and gravel was now gone. All the stones upstream of the dam were underwater. Every now and then, more shot and dirt, undercut by the widening stream, would fall into the water with a splash. Downstream of the dam, the water course was nearly empty. Thin trickles ran restlessly down its center, but that was all about all. Stones which had been underwater for God knew how long were drying in the sand. Eddie looked at these drying stones with mild wonder, and that weird other feeling. They had done this. They! He saw a frog hopping along and thought maybe old Mr. Froggy was wondering just where the water had gone. Eddie laughed out loud. Ben was neatly stowing his empty wrappers in the lunchbag he had brought. Both Eddie and Bill had been amazed by the size of the repast Ben had laid out with businesslike efficiency. 2 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, 1 bologna sandwich, a hard-cooked egg, complete with a pinch of salt twisted up in a small piece of wax paper, 2 fig bars, 3 large chocolate chip cookies, and a ring dink.
"What did your ma say when she saw how bad you got wrecked?"
Eddie asked him.
"Hmm?"
Ben looked up from the spreading pool of water behind the dam and belched gently against the back of his hand.
"Oh, well, I knew she'd be grocery shopping yesterday afternoon, so I was able to beat her home. I took a bath and washed my hair. Then I threw away the jeans and the sweatshirt I was wearing. I don't know if she'll notice they're gone or not. Probably not the sweatshirt. I got lots of sweatshirts. But I guess I ought to buy myself a new pair of jeans before she gets nosing through my drawers."
The thought of wasting his money on such a nonsensical item cast momentarily gloom across Ben's face.
What about the way you were bruised up?"
"I told her I was so excited to be out of school that I ran out the door and fell down the steps,"
Ben said, and looked both amazed and a little hurt when Eddie and Bill began laughing. Bill, who had been chewing up a piece of his mother's devil's food cake, blew out a brown jet of crumbs and then had a coughing fit. Eddie, still howling, clapped him on the back.
"Well, I almost did fall down the steps,"
Ben said.
"Only it was because Victor Chris pushed me, not because I was running."
"I'd be as hot as Tamil in a sweatshirt like that,"
Bill said, finishing the last bite of his cake. Ben hesitated. For a moment, it seemed he would say nothing.
"It's better when you're fat,"
he said finally.
"Sweatshirts, I mean."
"Because of your gut?"
Eddie asked. Bill snorted.
"Because of your
Yeah, my teeth. So what?"
"Yeah,"
Bill said mildly.
So what?
There was a moment of awkward silence, and then Eddie said,
Look how dark the water's getting when it goes around that side of the dam.
Oh, cripes!
Ben saw to his feet.
Current's pulling out the fuel. Yes, I wish we had cement.
The damage was quickly repaired, but even Eddie could see what would happen without someone there to almost constantly shovel in fresh fill. Erosion would eventually cause the upstream board to collapse against the downstream board, and then everything would fall over.
We can shore up the sides,
Ben said.
That won't stop the erosion, but it will slow it down.
If we use sand and mud, won't it just go on washing away?
Eddie asked.
We'll use chunks of sod.
Bill nodded, smiled, and made an O with the thumb and forefinger of his right hand.
Let's go. I'll dig him, and you show me where to put him in, Big Ben.
From behind them, a strident cheery voice called.
My God! Someone put the yacht pole down in the barns, belly button lint and all.
Eddie turned, noticing the way Ben tightened up at the sound of a strange voice, the way his lips thinned. Standing above them, and a ways upstream, on the path Ben had crossed the day before, were Richie Tozier and Stan Lewis. Richie came bobbing down to the stream, glanced at Ben with some interest, and then pinched Eddie's cheek.
Don't do that. I hate it when you do that, Richie.
Ah, you love it, Ed,
Richie said, and beamed at him.
So, what do you say? You having any good chicks, or what?